I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The World Health Organization has declared monkeypox a global public health emergency with more than 23,000 confirmed cases. In the United States, the CDC has identified nearly 6,000 cases of monkeypox, causing the governors of New York, California, and Illinois to declare states of emergency in order to ramp up testing and vaccinations, which are in critically short supply. The Philadelphia Health Department has identified 82 cases of monkeypox so far. Meanwhile, the coronavirus pandemic continues with a new highly contagious variant, BA5, resulting in 100,000 new cases every day. President Biden is dealing with a rebound coronavirus infection, having tested positive again this week, shortly after recovering from a previous infection. So today on Radio Times, what you need to know about these viruses to stay safe and protect the people in your life. Also, we'll talk about some of the lessons we should have learned from the coronavirus pandemic and our response to the monkeypox outbreak, including concerns about stigma. We have two guests. Dr. Perry Halkidis is dean of the Rutgers School of Public Health. He's a public health psychologist, infectious disease epidemiologist, applied statistician, and an advocate. Dr. Halkidis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us, Dr. Jay Varma. He's a professor of population health sciences and director of the Cornell Center for Pandemic Prevention and Response at Weill Cornell Medicine. He spent 20 years working for the CDC on infectious diseases in Africa, Asia, and in New York City, most recently leading the city's COVID-19 response from April 2020 to May 2021. Dr. Jay Varma, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I do want to begin with the president and this rebound coronavirus. I just want to make sure our listeners understand what it is. And perhaps, Dr. Varma, I could begin with you. What causes rebound coronavirus? Do we know?
Yeah, it's actually a phenomenon that we don't understand fully, but we have some theories about. Basically, the best way to think about it is that in somebody who has a lot of pre-existing immunity, particularly from vaccination, when you get infected, your body mounts a very strong immune response to fight off that virus. When you add in Paxlovid, this is kind of like another weapon that you're using to fight the virus, you can bring the virus levels down quite dramatically so that you test negative and that you feel much better, but it appears that you don't bring that level of virus down to zero. And because you've added in this kind of second weapon, this drug, your immune system doesn't develop the immune cells and the antibodies that it would need to bring this virus levels down to zero. So what happens is, somebody feels better and they test negative, but there's a very, very low amount of virus still in the body and your immune system is not reacting to it. And then after a few days, as that virus begins to replicate and get become more abundant, then your body's immune system kicks in and says, wait, you're still here. I have to fight you off. So that's what it appears is happening. And it doesn't appear that during cases of rebound, well, first of all, that it's very common. We estimate it probably only occurs in somewhere between 1 to 10% of cases. And number two is it doesn't appear that it any causes any severe outcomes at the end. What it does is it just makes it a more of an annoyance because you may have some small symptoms and you may have to stay isolated because you continue to test positive for a few more days.
Dr. Halkidis, let me go back to you. And actually picking up on something that Dr. Varma just said, is Paxlovid, is that, I don't mean to say part of the problem, but is using Paxlovid, does that create the possibility of rebound coronavirus?
I mean, I think that Paxlovid is actually one of the tools we have in our arsenal right now to try to keep this virus under control. At the end of the day, this virus is going to continue to spread, not because the virus outsmarts human beings, but because we as human beings continue to go about our lives as if there's no infection in our mix. And so I think ultimately, if I was to assign a culprit to what's going on right now, in addition to this very, very, very transmittable strain, which is this BA5 strain, I would say it's we as human beings going out into the world, assuming that there's no Omicron in our mix, that there's no COVID in our mix, that there's no monkeypox in our mix. And that, to me, is the ultimate culprit here in what's getting people sick and what's continuing to spread the disease in the United States.
Well, picking up on that, so should we mask up and distance and do the things that we were told to do, let's say, a year ago, Dr. Halkidis?
So that's an excellent question. And my response always to these questions is what I would tell my family members, which is, if you remain highly concerned, if you are navigating social spaces where there are people you don't know, you should mask. I continue to mask when I go to the store or to a social space where there are people whose infection or vaccination I do not know. And so I don't think there's an appetite in the United States right now for masking, but certainly for people who are concerned, vaccination and masking and probably not gathering in very large groups will prevent you from getting infected or reinfected. I'll say one more thing, though.
Sure.
I think that what we've seen with the vaccination, and I think Jay would agree with this, is that at a minimum, we have a situation right now where people who are vaccinated and boosted are not becoming severely ill. So that is the best tool we have. If you don't want to get reinfected, even if you have to avoid slight disease, you should also undertake those mitigation strategies.
And I do want to move on to monkeypox, but Dr. Varma, let me go back to you and even going back to the president getting coronavirus again. Apparently, the word from the White House is that, and he's been, I guess, on the job, is that he hasn't gotten that sick. So does that tell us something?
Well, it definitely tells us that, vaccines work. I think, Paxlovid is a very useful medication, but if you had to choose what your most important intervention is, it's getting fully vaccinated. And actually, let me correct that term, being up to date on vaccination. Because the challenge has been that for a number of reasons, people have been led to believe by our government that, two doses of an mRNA vaccine is sufficient. And what we've learned is that, first of all, we need better vaccines. We need vaccines that last longer and that cover more coronavirus future variants. But the other thing is that anybody who's 50 years old and above should have had 4 doses of vaccine. And anybody who's between the ages of 5 and 49 should have gotten at least 3 doses of vaccine. And if we don't do that more effectively, people are going to continue to get severely ill. And so I do think that the president, despite his advanced age, did well in this because he is fully up to date on his vaccines. And, of course, on top of that, has access to the best medical care possible.
Do we know how many people, Dr. Varma, in this country are not vaccinated, have never had a vaccination?
Oh, I don't have the number off the top of my head about never vaccinated. It's a bit of a challenge right now also because people do have some immunity from prior infections. It's just that what we've learned during this time is that immunity doesn't provide you with the same level of protection against these new and emerging variants. It's an interesting fact about the immune system that being primed with vaccines seems to prepare you much better than multiple prior infections. So that's one of the reasons it's so important to get the message out to anybody who's never had a vaccine dose that actually your protection from just prior infection is not nearly as strong as a combination of having been vaccinated and then potentially having been infected on top of that.
I do want to get back to coronavirus, but I'm toggling back and forth between that and monkeypox. So, Dr. Halkidis, if I can go back to you, where did monkeypox come from?
So monkeypox, the virus that causes monkeypox, or MPX, as we're beginning to call it right now, because there is some stigma associated with the term monkeypox, has been endemic to the African continent since the 1970s. So it is a virus that we have recognized for many decades that has existed. It has not permeated into Europe and the United States. Where it comes from now in this particular outbreak that we're seeing in Western Europe and in the United States and probably in other parts of the world relatively soon is that it entered into an event in Portugal, it seems, and in Belgium. And perhaps from a person who was traveling to Africa, perhaps from an African traveling to Portugal, who knows? The blame doesn't matter here. We shouldn't be assigning blame. The fact of the matter is it was at a social event. And at that social event, there were people from all over the world. And when there are people from all over the world who are traveling to go to something, and this is why I think is our pattern moving forward, We are a global society. We're going to socialize with each other. We're going to travel. This is going to happen. This is how it entered into our mix in May of 2022, and we find ourselves in our situation right now in the United States where we have a quarter of the world's infections.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things, and I'll go back to you, Dr. Halkidis. You talked about an event. Are we talking about an event where there was some kind of skin-to-skin contact?
It was a rave. So
it was a rave.
With yeah, it was a rave with many people. It was a rave catering primarily, and this is a really important point, catering primarily to the LGBTQ population. So therefore, it is not surprising that it is infecting the LGBTQ population. Had it been, I don't know, a quinceañera, or had it been a church picnic, it might look different than it does right now, but it so happened to be this event. And that's why I think it's really, really important, Marty, that we stress that this is not a gay disease, right? And I think it is. We have to be extremely clear on that message. Yes, it is affecting gay and bisexual men unduly right now, but it could have entered into the human population at any time. But it was a large event, people dancing, people socializing, skin-to-skin contact, boom, monkeypox.
Monkeypox. So it's really, it's a human-to-human transmission. It just so happens it's largely in the gay and bisexual community today, correct, Dr. Halkidis?
Yes, it is a human-to-human contact, and here's what I have been saying all along about MPX or monkeypox, which is, It is not, in my view, and it should not be called a sexually transmitted infection. If you are having sexual relations with someone and you have COVID and that person gets COVID, that is not making an STI.
Right.
This is the same situation here. This is not like gonorrhea and syphilis and chlamydia. This is a disease of skin-to-skin contact that could be easily transmitted regardless of sexual identity, gender identity, you know, age and what have you. And so it is not an STI. Skin-to-skin contact is really a huge culprit here in the transmission of monkeypox.
Dr. Varma, a minute before our first break here, what does the skin look like when it has MPX?
Yeah, and so and I would disagree a little bit with Perry on this point here. There is some concern here that direct insertive intercourse may be a factor in this, and we've seen this by a number of lines of evidence, including people getting lesions only on their genital area in the area where they had either receptive or insertive intercourse, the detectable virus in sexual fluids. So there's just a lot that we don't know. Perry is absolutely correct that the primary mode of transmission is skin to skin, but there is quite a lot of emerging evidence, particularly also that this may have emerged actually among gay men and their sexual health networks in Nigeria, places where homophobia is ingrained in law, and so it's basically almost impossible to investigate. But what's been challenging with this for the skin lesions themselves, as you note, is that under classical circumstances, you get a cluster of marks all over your body that are like bumps, and they have kind of a firmness to them, and they're very characteristic. But what's been difficult about this outbreak is because it's been among gay men and their sexual health networks, and because it is been mostly associated with direct sexual activity, some people are only getting a small bump maybe on their penis or inside their anus with a lot of discomfort.
You know what?
Can get very easily confused with other things.
I tell you what, a very short break. We'll pick up on that. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with our guests about the latest on COVID-19, also what we're learning about monkeypox. And let me just quickly reintroduce our guests. Dr. Perry Halkidis is Dean of the Rutgers School of Public Health. Dr. Jay Varma is Professor of Population Health Sciences, Director of the Cornell Center for Pandemic Prevention and Response. That's at the Weill Cornell Medicine. And again, you can join us. In fact, we already have lots of comments coming in. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Dr. Varma, let me pick up with you. You were describing what some of these lesions can look like, and then Dr. Halkidis, I'll go back to you. But let's just make sure we understand what the skin looks like so people know what to look for.
Yeah, and it's difficult to say it's any one appearance, but let me give you the most classical presentation, but then also describe the different variations. So the most classical presentation that you're seeing right now, and by classical I mean during this current outbreak, is a skin mark occurring in a man somewhere in their genital or anal area that is often described as a bump. In medicine, we call it a papule. It basically means it's a bump, but it doesn't appear to have any fluid in it, and it's not very large. And then over time, that papule becomes painful, and it also can get to have fluid in it so that it feels very firm underneath the skin, almost like a really tiny little balloon with a very firm edge to it. At the same time that that one lesion may be developing, you will then start to develop similar marks in other parts of your body. And again, during this outbreak, because it's been mostly among gay men and their sexual health networks, it's in your genital and anal area and very painful. It's often also accompanied by swelling of your lymph nodes, particularly in your groin area. So you might feel a lump in kind of your groin or the crease of your, where your hips and legs come together. You can also very commonly get these bumps or marks in other parts of your body. Again, if it was a sex-related contact that you had, many people will get them in their mouth, and then they're very painful and uncomfortable and very obvious. You can get them on your face and your arms and your legs and other parts of your body as well. And in the descriptions of this outbreak, descriptions of monkeypox from investigations in Central West Africa that were not associated with sex-related, contact, very often people got bumps all over their body at the exact same time.
Wow.
So we will expect to see that in the future when there are infections that are transmitted by other forms of skin-to-skin contact and outside of these social and sexual networks when they end up in other groups as well.
Dr. Halkidis, a couple of questions for you. One of them, can it be transmitted asymptomatically in that you don't have these lesions and bumps, but you are positive for monkeypox? Can you spread it that way, or do you need to have these lesions?
Yeah, so the lesions are the most efficient way to spread it. But however, we know that it can take up to several weeks to show symptoms of the disease. And as a result of that, people can be symptomatic, may not even be aware that they have a bump, right? People may not, we know with the in syphilis, for example, that people are not even aware that they have a lesion when they have syphilis and they transmit it. So that's very, very highly possible. And, as Dr. Varma said, it's these social networks right now. I mean, I hesitate to use the word sexual networks because I think what it does at the end of the day is also starts to it's an opportunity for people to stigmatize, gay sex, the kind of sex that men have with each other. It's these social networks that often involve sex that, that is leading to the transmission. So yes, to your question, it's possible. And we are learning every single day, as Dr. Varma said, exactly how it's manifesting here, how it looks different from the past, how it's being transmitted. There is evidence absolutely that there is MPX in semen and in testes, but you know what? There are 27 other viruses that exist in the semen also that have been detected as per studies. So it's not that this is just, I want to reemphasize, I hesitate to call this a sexually transmitted infection.
Yeah, no, I hear you both. Let me go back to you, Dr. Halkidis, though. If those who are at risk are men who have sex with men, how do we target, a message and yeah, treatment and even prevention without stigma, without, in a sense, targeting these people for potential discrimination and stigma?
I love that question. And I'm old enough to remember the outbreak of AIDS in the 1980s, right? So I was in New York City at the time, a young gay man, at 18 years old in 1981. And I remember reading the stories in the New York Times about this outbreak. Look, and I remember at the time also Larry Kramer, one of the heroes of the LGBTQ movement, saying very clearly to all of us in our meetings, we need to relax our sexual behavior. And I think the message is really clear. I think the message is first and foremost to acknowledge, yes, of course, monkeypox can affect everyone, but it is primarily affecting gay and bisexual men right now in their social networks, often through sexual transmission, which means intimate contact. We should message also to gay and bisexual men that perhaps it is wise at this point to be more cautious in their sexual transactions. We should also message vaccinate as soon as possible if you're a sexually active man. And I say this particularly for young men, and I'm sure Dr. Varma will speak to this also. For those of us who were born before 1972 in the United States, we have a smallpox vaccination. I know there is some evidence that that might be protective, but young men who are socializing, my target and messaging would be young men, young gay men who are socializing with each other, who are having sex with each other, one, vaccinate, but two, also think carefully about your sexual behavior, knowing that one, you may be infected and it's very painful, but two, as a member of the gay and bisexual male community, we have a responsibility to care for each other and to love each other.
And wearing a condom, I mean, is that what you're talking about?
I think wearing a condom is always a good idea. You know, pre-exposure prophylaxis for the prevention of HIV, you know, has certainly been a game changer. But there are numerous other sexually transmitted infections. I was actually giggling the other day when I was watching an episode of the Netflix show Uncoupled, where, Neil Patrick Harris is out in the world having sex again, and he has sex with a man who is on PrEP and doesn't want to use a condom. And Neil Patrick Harris is old enough to remember the time where we always use condoms. Look, condoms are still helpful for the transmission of numerous other sexually transmitted infections. We know there are versions of gonorrhea that are hard to treat out there. No one wants to get syphilis. Chlamydia is, you know, run.
Oh, dear. I think we lost Dr. Halkidis. We will try to get him back. Dr. Varma, do we still have you?
Yes, I am.
Okay,
yeah.
Very
Seems
good.
Like I got disconnected for 1 second.
Yeah,
sorry,
yeah, yeah.
Now
no,
I'm back
no, no,
on.
No. Yep. You're good. That's good. Okay, that's good. Let me just pick up on something. We'll get Dr. Halkidis back on the line. But let me ask you about vaccines, which my understanding is that if you can get them and we have a severe shortage, that they can be effective against monkeypox. Why do we have a shortage of these vaccines?
Yeah, this gets back to sort of the original sin of this outbreak. And I'll just start by just letting your listeners know that, you know, if there was ever going to be a disease, you know, a pandemic potential disease threat that the U.S. was going to face that we were prepared for, it should have been monkeypox. You know, the U.S. had been concerned about smallpox, which is kind of a sister virus, and it prepared vaccines and drugs and even diagnostic tests for just this type of event. But there was a delayed awareness and recognition of what this disease could threaten the U.S. in May, even though there were very explosive outbreaks being reported from major European cities. And we know that, you know, there's a lot of travel and movement, both social networks as well as business related activity between, Europe and the U.S. And that, of course, we know New York would be among the first to be hit. So there was a delay in basically getting a vaccine order in place. That's number one. Number two, on top of that, the U.S., you know, doesn't try to reveal normally what's in its vaccine stockpile, you know, the quantities, because it views that as sort of a national security issue. But now the reporting has shown that, in fact, the U.S. let, over a million doses, or I think over several hundred thousand doses of these vaccines expire without restocking them in the stockpile. And so in addition to U.S. having sort of a delayed order in May, it didn't have nearly as many dosages on hand as it was normally supposed to have. And then the third barrier to that is that the response depended upon a certain number of vaccines being held kind of in their raw form in Europe and then being put into, you know, vials that can be actually given to doctors' offices. And that process actually takes some time. So this delayed recognition also slowed down the ability to do that. So we're going to be in this situation, unfortunately, for several months where the demand and need for vaccine is far greater than the actual supply.
And that's such a worrisome thing to think about and a reflection on our health system and our public health system. Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Dr. Jay Varma, Professor of Population Health Sciences, Director of the Cornell Center for Pandemic Prevention and Response, and that's at Weill Cornell Medicine. Also with us, and he's back, is Dr. Perry Halkidis, Dean of the Rutgers School of Public Health. He's also a public health psychologist, infectious infectious disease epidemiologist, applied statistician, and advocate. And again, you can join us. Any questions or comments toggling back and forth between COVID and monkeypox, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call 1-888-477-9499. Here's a tweet from Laurie. She just wants to know, can you get monkeypox, she asks, from a public washer and dryer? I think the question, she has a daughter who lives in New York City, and she's worried about her doing the laundry. And I guess that raises a question just about how contagious it is and, you know, how worried we should be if we're not having human-to-human contact with monkeypox. Do we have to think about things like sheets and bed sheets and touching things? Dr. Halkidis?
I mean, you know, we do have to worry about bed sheets. We have to worry about bed sheets only if there's lesions that have been, you know, exploded on the bed sheets. But, you know, this is reminiscent to me of, again, of the early 1980s when doorknobs and toilet seats and what have you were all potentially sources of HIV, which we know they weren't. And you know, in COVID-19, when we were dealing with, like, our supermarket bags, you know, these similar patterns seem to emerge. So generally, yes, skin-to-skin contact is the biggest concern. I would not be worrying about the washing machine. Yes, sheets could be a problem if there's somebody who has monkeypox and has lesions, and and it's oozed all over the sheets. I don't know, Marty, if this message came through, but I wanted to reinforce it just one more time, which is wearing a condom is just a good idea all the time,
right?
For
right.
any reason at all for gay and bisexual men. So I think that monkeypox or not, condom use is really important, but. Dr. Verma, what do you think about the washing machine?
Yeah, what do you think about the washing machine and the sheets? Also, go ahead.
Sure, yeah, and I'll make a note about condoms. And I know Perry maybe this is a source of tension and debate. Is you know, but the UK is also recommending that people who had monkeypox infection resolved continue to wear a condom for several weeks after that because. Monkeypox is detectable in semen, similar to what we've seen with Ebola and Zika virus. Again, we don't know how infectious it is, but simply as what we consider a precautionary principle, since there are no harms associated with condom use. And as Perry notes, they are protective against other things. And in terms of washing machines, so I want to differentiate here between you live in the home and share linens and bed sheets and other things with somebody who has monkeypox from you just happen to live in a city that has a lot of people with monkeypox. So the first scenario, infection control is a concern. We know that people who have these skin marks, that a virus can survive for some time. We don't know the exact duration, but it's at least hours, and it could be days, on bed linens, towels, and other things. Washing machines that are operating properly in that home generate enough heat and have enough cleaning solution in them that they will disinfect those materials, but you yourself should not be handling them. The patient, if they are well enough, should be putting them in the washing machine, washing them, and removing them from there, and you should avoid sharing things as much if you live in the home. Now, if you just happen to live in New York City and live in a building where somebody has a monkeypox or something else, I would not be concerned at this time. I personally am not concerned about it for myself. And that's because the absolute number of cases is relatively small compared to the overall population. These skin marks and lesions are quite discomforting. And so people are not out and about spreading them routinely to other people. And I would really caution people from this because it really does play into the incredible, you know, homophobia and stigma that's going to continue to be amplified as this epidemic goes on.
Indeed. Let me pick up on the numbers. As I said, at least so far in Philadelphia, the health department has identified 82 cases of monkeypox. I think we all agree that there are probably more cases around the world. In the United States, the CDC, something like 6,000 cases. The World Health Organization talking about more than 23,000 cases. To you, Dr. Halkidis, in the big scheme of things, if we're talking about, you know, a world population of billions and billions of people, why do these numbers call for emergency response?
I mean, I think they call for emergency response because we've learned from the past, right? And, anybody who's studied infectious disease epidemiology or public health in general will tell you that, you know, for years, professors were teaching their students about the control of infectious diseases in the world since 21, 22, 23. And since 1981, it's actually moved in a slightly different direction. And so the lessons learned from HIV and COVID-19 is that we need to react and react quickly. Our response to the monkeypox outbreak right now is indicative of a response that, okay, may not have been as fast as I would care it to be, but is relatively quickly. Is happening relatively quickly. And I think the lesson that we learned here is that we can contain this and we can control it if we elevate it to a point where we acknowledge it and say it could become a crisis. When we did not do that in the 1980s in the United States, granted, HIV was a novel virus and we weren't familiar with it, but we stayed silent on it for such a long time and people's lives were taken. In this particular case, we are at least acknowledging it, putting it out there, calling for emergencies in certain states, and as a result of that, raising the awareness. I've heard physicians say that had they seen these rashes or these blisters on people's bodies previously, like in the early part of the year, they might not have thought of monkeypox. But by raising the consciousness in the population, we are controlling the virus, and ultimately, this is a good public health strategy.
Let me pick up with something, and I'll go back to you, Dr. Halkidis, and I certainly remember the homophobia of the AIDS epidemic, and I wonder the sort of state of the world today. You know, on the one hand, there, you know, we've got same-sex marriage and marriage equality and things like that. On the other hand, you know, we see LGBTQA communities being targeted for all sorts of political reasons. So are we in the same sort of dire situation when it comes to homophobia?
So I think we are in not as dire a situation as we might have been in the 1950s or in the 1980s, but we're certainly not in a situation where we were a few years ago. Absolutely, you are right, Marty, to raise the fact that there are numerous initiatives around the country, whether they be in Florida with regard to saying being openly gay and discussing gay issues, or when we see, or where we see throughout the United States, where one in five LGBTQ people don't go to the doctor because they think physicians are ill-prepared. Mm-hmm. So we are at a point right now where individuals who are LGBTQ are being, you know, wary. We are cautious that SCOTUS is going to overturn marriage equality. And you're correct. In the wrong hands, this information around monkeypox can be misconstrued to be a gay disease. Again, this is why I don't want to just talk about gay sex when I talk about monkeypox, because that information in the wrong hands gets misconstrued. And we have to think about, you know, diseases not just as biological phenomenon. I appreciate the fact that they exist, that this disease exists on genitals and exists in the anus, but as social constructions. And human beings are social operators. They're not rational operators. And so,
you know what? Hold on.
That might.
Yeah, and I hate to do this only because we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. I'll pick up on that after this short break. We'll be right back.
Great. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine. What's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with our guest, Dr. Perry Halkidis and Dr. Jay Varma, about what we know about monkeypox and getting an update on coronavirus. We have a lot of comments here, and I do want to get to them. Most of them, I have to say, are about coronavirus. But Dr. Halkidis, can you just finish your thought? I had to interrupt you very roughly right before that break. Go ahead.
Sorry about that, Marty.
No,
you
not,
know, I
not
get
your
really
fault.
Like emotional and passionate about
sure,
these things.
Sure, I get it.
So, you know, I was talking about like making sure that we understand that diseases like monkeypox and COVID and HIV are as much social phenomenon as they are biological phenomenon, and that at the end of the day we're dealing with human beings, and human beings are not rational operators. And so, keeping in mind very closely the social manifestations, the social constructions of disease in our society is going to be really key, because viruses don't outsmart us. We're just dumb in our reaction to them. Huh. And so working really closely with people and understanding how we can avoid stigma and how we can make sure people make the right decisions because people often make decisions based on emotions, is what we need to do. So thank you for letting me finish that thought.
No, absolutely. It's so critical. Let me read a lot of comments from our listeners here. And Dr. Varma, I'll put the first one to you. This is from John. He says, I've never gotten COVID symptoms and I've never worn a mask. What do we need to know about natural immunity and what percentage of people may have natural immunity? Is he just lucky or is there something at work here? Dr. Varma.
Yeah, I'll just start by just saying that the term natural immunity doesn't really exist. Immunity is natural, whether or not it's been prompted by a vaccine or by a virus or some other phenomenon. Is it possible that this person is one of those rare people whose immune system is somehow primed to recognize this virus and can defeat it before they develop any symptoms? Yes, it is possible. We know even with diseases like HIV, which we consider 100% lethal if you aren't treated, there are some rare exceptions of people who have genetic changes that somehow make them able to not be infected and not develop the complications of it. So yes, there are rare exceptions where people do it. I'm generally skeptical in those situations because there are many people who I even met in my personal life that will say, oh no, I just have an allergy or I don't ever get sick, and then you'll hear them cough. And when in fact they were very lucky, and when they've had COVID infections in the past, they've been extremely mild and not severe. So yes, there are extremely rare circumstances in which some people do in fact have an immune system that is primed to do this. And it may be not just because of the way you were born. It may be because of what you were exposed to as a child, which is very hard to understand. But again, there are other coronaviruses that circulate. It's possible to have cross immunity, but it is extremely uncommon.
But are you also saying that people who think they have not had coronavirus, I'm one of those people, might have had it, we just didn't know it because we were asymptomatic or we thought we had a cold or sort of misunderstood what our potential symptoms were?
It is absolutely possible. I mean, if you had to take a bet, I would bet that most people who say they've never had coronavirus probably had it.
Really?
That doesn't mean you're lying. It doesn't mean it didn't, and it doesn't also mean that you weren't uninfected. There's a lot of people trying to estimate, what percentage of the U.S. population was never infected. It's believed to be very small, somewhere in the range of, less than 5%. But that doesn't mean you aren't part of that 5%, and it doesn't also mean that those estimates are absolute. It's one of the biggest challenges that we have with COVID and many other infectious diseases. There isn't an excellent marker to tell you, first of all, whether or not you are ever infected, and second of all, what your level of protection is right now. One of the real technologies that we've been missing during this epidemic is something that we have for a number of other diseases, and that's basically a lab test that says, if I draw this blood test, I know you're protected, regardless of whether you've gotten zero vaccine doses or you've gotten four. What we call a correlative protection. And when we have that assay in the future, which a lot of people have been trying to work on, we'll be better able to draw a distinction and understand whether it is that you are protected just simply because you had that existing protection or because you were infected in the past.
Here's a question from John, who says, your guest just said to be fully vaccinated for COVID, we should have two shots and two boosters. I believe that's for the older set. Why doesn't the CDC say that? Also, there's very little on the CDC website about mitigation steps we should be taking. Dr. Halkidis, has the CDC fallen down on the job when it comes to COVID?
The CDC,
I know it's a loaded question, but no, go ahead. They do. Yes.
I know, but I'll answer it. I'm a New Yorker. I'll answer it for you, Marty. The CDC has had some challenges. The public health in general has had challenges over the course of the last, decade or so because it's been gutted. I think that the messaging has been consistently unclear. I spend a field on any given day calls from family and friends about what they should do next because they go to these websites and they're not clear. I think there is a political reality that the CDC is dealing with that manifests in some of the messaging that's out there. And so have they fallen down the job? Not necessarily, but are they providing the clearest possible message so that we as Americans can say, oh, this is clear, I know what to do? No, we're not doing that. And It's unfortunate because I think people just want to be told what to do to keep themselves safe.
Well, we could do a whole hour on this, Dr. Jay Varma. I'm looking at a piece actually that you had, I think it was in The Atlantic, how public health failed America. But nonetheless, yes, we have the CDC. We've got, you know, health departments in cities, and we've got health departments in states across the country. We have a complicated healthcare system. Plus, we don't have national healthcare that covers everybody. Does that help describe kind of our halting attempts to kind of stem and deal with these viruses?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely important for people to understand that the federal government, particularly CDC, has very limited authority when it comes to public health. And that's not that's not just a unique phenomenon of the past several years. Our Constitution is designed in such a way that the primary authority for most public health measures resides with state and local governments. So when I, you know, wrote that essay in The Atlantic, it wasn't so much about the challenges that CDC has had, of which there have been many and they've been very well documented, but it's really discussing kind of a failure of our democracy, you know, at the state and local level to invest sufficiently in public health agencies, having the staff to deploy during times of crises. So to do door-to-door testing initiatives or door-to-door vaccination drives. And that's something that has, you know, happened over the past 30 years. And I think it's very important for listeners. If there's one thing I can tell you, if you're listening to this and it means you probably care, today is as good a day as any to call your state or local representative, your city council person or your local county person, and your federal representative and senators and say, what are you doing to protect public health in this country? Because until we get people demanding that public health be well-resourced the same way we demand that of police departments and fire departments, we're going to maintain at high risk from threats.
Let me just quote you, and then I do want to move on. This is from this piece, Dr. Varma. You say, strengthening the social safety net, particularly through universal health care, paid sick leave, housing, and child care, will improve Americans' ability to fend off COVID-19 and other threats. I'll just kind of leave that out there. Dr. Halkidis, a couple of questions about lesions and monkeypox. Christine says, can you explain a little more when the lesions are contagious? Are they split open? She says, my daughter is a masseuse, so these are things that I think about and potentially worry about. Can you respond to Christine's question?
I mean, the lesions manifest in a variety of different ways. Of course, they can break open. For a masseuse, in this particular point in time, being careful about any kind of rash that appears on a person's body would be critically important, whether or not it's due to monkeypox or not. So my response to Christine would be that her daughter should take precautions to make sure that when she's doing massage that she at least has gloves or other protections on, and that to not assume that what somebody thinks is just a regular rash may just be a regular rash at this point in time.
And Judah asks, how serious is a monkeypox infection? Has anyone died from monkeypox in the United States? Dr. Halkidis?
Mortality rate for monkeypox is extremely, extremely, extremely low. At this point, I do not believe there's been any deaths in the United States. So that is a good thing, unlike HIV, which was a sure death sentence in the absence of antiretroviral therapy. But it is not a comfortable disease. It is a painful disease. And so, while certainly people will not likely die from it, it is a period of great discomfort when they've been infected with the virus.
And what do you do if you are infected? And obviously you want to stay home, but nonetheless, what's the treatment?
Yeah, there are various, you know, balms and stuff that people use, but rest, relaxation, there are treatments that are available in some cases when people have outbreaks, but for the most part, it is about, you know, like it was, like what I'm saying to my colleagues right now or my friends right now who are having BA5 infections, which is, you know, stay home, you have to rest, you have to drink fluids, you have to monitor your symptoms and just make sure the trajectory over time is not a trajectory where the disease gets worse, but the disease gets better.
Here's a related question to you, Dr. Varma, from one of our listeners. COVID is spreading so rapidly, it's dangerous to suggest that COVID is less severe when we don't know what will happen to each person who gets it. Wear an N95 or better, especially around people who don't live in our household. I mean, how should we talk about COVID now?
This is one of the most challenging questions there is right now. So the question is, who is talking and who are you talking to, right? So at the national level, and actually I would say even at the state and local level, and that includes in places that are, you know, very progressive like Philadelphia or New York, there has been a very demonstrable and dramatic shift away from a collective view, we're all in this together, to one that's an individual view. We have tools have been made available by government or commercial entities, and it's your job to use them if you care about your risk. So what I generally have been speaking to individuals and to sort of the general public is the government has largely left you on your own. So now is a time to really think about what is it that you can do for yourself to manage your risk. And I think of it like a risk budget. Mm-hmm. So if you are at high risk yourself, you know, because of medical conditions, you should be wearing the most highly protective mask in as many settings as possible and being very careful the same way people have been. If you are less worried about your own individual risk because of your health conditions, you can consider doing more activities than you might normally. I would say that you should be careful and that there is a budget associated with this. And even think of that from a purely self-interested perspective. You know, if you're going on a vacation, you know, I would strongly suggest you wear a mask, even if you're one of those people that isn't worried about your own personal health from COVID. Mm-hmm. You're at high risk of getting infected multiple times in a year, and that's going to ruin your vacation. So I really would emphasize to individuals out there to think carefully, because there is a lot of transmission going on, and we will get to a point when we get better vaccines and even better treatments. But unfortunately, the virus is still outpacing us in many ways still.
Dr. Halkidis, I saw a study from the Kaiser Family Foundation, actually it was a survey, 43% of parents of children under the age of 6 months, or I should say between the ages of 6 months and 4 years, have said that they were refused to get a vaccination for their children, and another 27% were uncertain whether they would or not. So we're talking about young children, young, potentially very vulnerable children. What do we say to those parents?
What we say to those parents is, look what happens in our world when we don't have people vaccinated. Look what happens. We have a case of polio that's been identified in the United States. Look at what's happening with monkeypox. So my response to them, and this is it sort of tags on to what Dr. Varma said about COVID, which is, one, you have to make logical choices. You have to use common sense. If you are somebody who has trouble walking and it is a snowstorm outside, maybe you shouldn't go out walking if you can avoid it. Mm-hmm. But number two, I think we need to appeal to people's emotional lives, because people make decisions very often based on their emotional lives. And my response to those parents would be, you are doing everything in your power to keep your child safe and healthy. The decision not to vaccinate your child is putting your child at risk. Mm-hmm. That's what I would say to them if they were to ask me about the vaccine for their children.
Dr. Varma, we're almost out of time, but I'm thinking of monkeypox and certainly coronavirus and other viruses that transmit across, you know, from animals to humans. Are we going to see more of this as we sort of live closer and closer contact with wild animals?
Everybody out there who's listening right now needs to recognize that we are in a new age of pandemics. And the reason is because, and this is something that those of us who work in this field have been predicting for many years. There's basically several factors, and I'll summarize them very quickly. First of all, we have increasing human interaction with animals. People around the world want to consume more protein, so they are encroaching into areas and interacting with animals in ways that they weren't before. Number two, we have deforestation. Humans are merging, you know, exploring areas and interacting in areas with animals and interacting in ways that were not done in the past. Third, we have increasing urban urbanization, so it's easier for disease to spread person to person. Fourth, we have increasing migration and travel. So if a disease is in a big city, in one city, it's going to end up in another city very quickly. And the last is the force of climate change, which is accelerating all of those factors, migration, deforestation, human interaction with animals, because animals have to leave certain climate areas to move to one that's more hospitable to them. And it's also changing the spread of mosquitoes. So we as a society need to understand that just like September 11th changed it and we lived in a more dangerous world where terrorism would come to our doorstep, we need to be prepared for pandemics. And it's, again, yet another call to speak up, because our process here depends on democracy, and elected officials only care about the issues that voters make them care about. And we really want to make them care about public health.
Well, we do indeed, and we have to leave it there. And we learned so much during this hour. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Dr. Jay Varma, thanks for talking to us here in the Philadelphia area.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. And Dr. Perry Halkidis, same to you. Thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you for joining us.